Hey everyone, I'm your host Piers Kicks, and welcome back to Metaverse Musings, which is a research-focused podcast that's part of Delphi Digital. We explore the integral components behind what many believe will be the internet's successor, a virtual extension of the natural world where most of us will eventually live, work, and play. To some, it represents our next great milestone as a network species, and to others, it is something to fear. With our guests, we discuss the technology, philosophy, and culture behind this brave new world. If you're not yet subscribed to the Delphi Research Portal, then I fear for your soul. You're missing out on the most incisive analysis that the digital asset space has to offer. Seriously, check it out. Nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. This podcast features sponsors, and any ads are not an endorsement by Delphi Digital and are for informational purposes only. Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode of Metaverse Musings. I'm delighted to introduce you to Arif Khan, who is the founder and CEO of Alethea, which is described as a trusted synthetic media protocol. Arif, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Pierce, for having me, and really excited to chat and share a little bit more about Alethea.
Perfect. Could you start us off with a quick summary of what the project is and what you guys are aiming to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. Alethea AI is a protocol to create, share, and monetize synthetic media. And synthetic media broadly is AI-generated media, media that is created by artificial intelligence that looks and sounds human. I try and explain it as simply as possible to people, where if they've tried synthetic meat before, right, like tofu or any of these impossible burgers, It tastes like the real thing. It sounds like feels like the real thing, but it's not real meat, right? But synthetic media or AI-generated media is really text-based, video-based, visual or auditory as well, and can also be in the AR or VR worlds, where you can generate artificially intelligent characters and actually make them come to life. So I'm definitely excited about the possibility of content creation being scaled up using artificial intelligence, especially with cutting-edge tools like GPT-3, where the program itself, for example, has passed the Turing test and is able to replicate and mimic human language structure and respond accordingly. So you think you're talking to a human, but actually it's an AI, and the content creation possibilities are immense and tremendous. Of course, the harms as well, I am not blind to any of that. The opportunity here to become a protocol for something like this is where you can allow people to essentially, in our case especially, because we're pioneering a new standard called the INFT standard, where we are looking at giving NFTs, existing NFTs, or getting people to create NFTs, giving them the opportunity to have these NFTs be imbued with intelligence and the ability to interact. So essentially, we're giving NFTs superpowers. And the way we're thinking about this is that there is a whole landscape of creators that want their static images and their GIFs or video content to come alive and be able to interact and engage. That's sort of just the main idea behind a lot of our thinking, that we are going to move to an interactive synthetic reality where we would be talking with this AI beings and virtual beings and characters, and they may be powered by intelligence that is state of the art, and we would be able to have conversations with them and have meaningful experiences with them.
It's a fascinating concept, super exciting. But I'm curious, how exactly does one become equipped to tackle such a problem? What was your background leading up to this project? And we'd love some color around that.
Yeah. Prior to this, I was the chief marketing officer at SingularityNet, which was really helpful background, because my friend Ben Gertzel, he was the pioneer and pioneered the term and launched it into the world, a term called AGI, which is artificial general intelligence. And I worked with him for a couple of years in really facilitating a platform where people would come and learn about this idea, but also interact with software that is essentially open source AI software, and interact with it with the native AGI token, right? So the opportunity there when I was there was I had an opportunity to work with a robot called Sophia as well. And Sophia is a very interesting character because she has about 100,000 followers on Twitter. And my my main thing was to be able to actually bring this character to life in some ways and allow her to scale her presence and have that be a brand ambassador for SingularityNet. So my background primarily before that was in the Web2 world, where I led product marketing and strategy at Grab, which is a SoftBank-backed company, and then before that at LinkedIn. When I made the jump to crypto and AI, I was really just exploring the edges in around 2017, just before the first major bull run in the past 3 years, just trying to learn and understand what Ethereum was, how does AI fit into all of this. Really at the core of it, I'm just a curious mind trying to find my way in the world. And I think that's one of the reasons why I started this company as well.
So what was it then, you know, during those investigations, what was the kind of trigger moment for you? What was the core motivation that drove you to build this?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges was, I joke about this, but like just going through airport security with Sophia, the robot, is a major problem, right? So like the issue was, first, I am Singaporean and I grew up in Singapore, but I have a Middle Eastern look, right? So people don't necessarily understand that, you know, you can have a Middle Eastern look, but still be Singaporean. And airport security, especially in the US, doesn't understand that. So they give you a lot of special treatment. So the challenge then becomes even worse when you're traveling with a robot and you have to separate the robot's torso and the head and put that robot in a suitcase and go through airport security. Then you really get weird looks, right? And we were doing all of this just to set her up in a conference or event. And she would then end up speaking at that event, and we would have a video production crew there. And the cost, the staggering cost of video production, and at the same time, the staggering cost of travel was immense, right? So I think the main output that was then created from all of this in all of this travel plus video production was really significant. And I was trying to deeply think about what tools can really help us scale her presence out or scale her language structure out, and her ability to speak multiple languages, right? So she could only speak in one language, which was English. So like, how can we actually enable that at scale? So I started looking at deep fakes a little bit, and then later on GANs, and trying to understand what AI was doing in the content creation space and how far away we are from very realistic content. And from a text-based standpoint, OpenAI's GPT-3 engine has already sort of passed that, right? Like it can mimic humans, but from a visual language, visual standpoint, we're still deep in the uncanny valley in terms of like human faces and characters. But we are certainly in a very beautiful design space with NFTs, because NFTs are so, NFT art and NFT characters are so unique that they have a category or class of their own, right? So that's sort of the early intersections. I started getting curious about how to solve my own problem, launched a company foolishly just before the pandemic, and then have now seen the opportunity and impact that is possible, because you can now scale character creation and allow people to build some very, very unique characters that happen to also be intelligent and can interact with you.
What would you say then is different about the kind of approach that you've taken that's allowed you to kind of execute upon this opportunity where perhaps others haven't?
Yeah, we thought deeply about integrating all of the AI tools under one umbrella. So that means we don't want to be a specialist AI company, and we don't want to be a specialist in terms of just doing voice cloning or visual face masking or face swapping. We see those companies as certainly valuable to the ecosystem, but fundamentally we've taken an approach where how do we recreate the human persona? And that approach allows us to look at a person's language structure, which can be replicated using GPT-3, a person's voice. There's really impactful technology out there that can do that today, but not to the degree that it is emotive or that has the timbre or the inflections that a human voice normally has, right? So there are certain limitations on the technology, but what we did was we integrated all of these synthetic tools under one umbrella, an AI studio of sorts that allows people to now create these characters and actually bring them to life.
Super interesting. And then
I guess, where does the blockchain and I guess, obviously, if you could give some more color around the NFT angle, but where did that, sort of come from initially? Why did you feel that blockchain was a sensible way to try and execute this?
Yeah. So, I mean, once you started looking at like text that was synthetically generated and we could no longer distinguish whether text-based content was human-generated or machine-generated or spam, right? I mean, it could be spam, but is it a human behind it that's generating the spam? Or is it actually a machine-generated spam? We can't distinguish that today at all. And it goes into our spam folders, we sort of disregard it. The same with video content, and that's happening today, where deepfakes have gone sort of into the public consciousness, and people, we are able to certainly distinguish sometimes now when a deepfake is sort of badly done or amateurishly produced. But for example, the Tom Cruise deepfakes that people may have seen certainly indicate that the possibility that content creation is getting so close to the real thing, or AI generated content creation is getting so close to the real thing that we may not be able to distinguish this from reality. And this is where the blockchain's provenance and the opportunity to understand content provenance comes in, which is understanding at a very deep level whether that piece of content has been manipulated, how it has sort of moved through the ecosystem. That is a very sophisticated and complex problem to solve if you try and create an entire ecosystem that maps the entire content ecosystem, and you try and track all of the provenance of these pieces. It doesn't work very well. What we found that worked really well was the non-fungible token is an excellent sort of container for property rights, for property rights infrastructure, for faces, voices, for IP that we have today. So if, for example, you're a character or you're a celebrity like Lady Gaga, you could create, for example, a verified virtual twin that would have your voice, your face, your personality trained on your Twitter or Instagram messages, and you could then actually create sort of an initial sketch or composite of that virtual twin of Lady Gaga, right? So the non-fungible token is quite interesting because it sort of mimics what real life is, because we're non-fungible consciousness ourselves, right? Like we're each individual and scarce, and we're sort of our own unique persons. And the opportunity here is at the NFT level, it really allows us to create that scarcity, but also it serves as a very powerful mechanism to capture the property rights of a specific person. So that's how we think about it in terms of how the blockchain comes in and how these characters can actually be, how that IP can be captured on the blockchain. But now if you want to push it further, it's about how do we now make this IP dynamic, interactive, and engaging. And this is where the AI layer really comes in, because now it can take that NFT and actually make it come alive. So we just saw, I was just on Telegram and I had somebody reached out to me as, you know, one of these pseudonymous people normally do, and they said that they own an NFT of this NFT that just sold for $500,000 called the Overly Attached Girlfriend NFT. I don't know whether you've heard of that.
I haven't seen the NFT, but I'm familiar with the meme.
Yeah. So the meme, what was sold is actually a still image, right? And the person heard about, this pseudonymous person heard about our technology, which allows you to make the NFT interactive and engaging. And so approached us and said, can we make this NFT meme now be interactive and engaging? That means I want the Overly Attached Girlfriend to be a full character on a site, and people and anybody who has access to that character gets the opportunity to interact with the Overly Attached Girlfriend. And she may actually end up being a full personality that genuinely reminds you and embodies a personality of being overly attached.
Right? Well, I hope there are no push notifications enabled, but yeah.
Absolutely. And that's exactly where you can really stretch the programmability aspect of NFTs as a medium, where you can now think really deeply a little bit about how should the NFT become intelligent? What personality should it have? What rights should it have? Does it, and how much access should you give it in terms of like your ecosystem and your personal life, in terms of like, where do you want to store it? Do you want it to have access to push notifications, the ability to email, the ability to generate text, the ability to send you a reminder or alarm? Right. So like things like that become very, very interesting because you're now taking it to the nth degree, right? As to how much interactivity and engagement they can have, and you're making them actual full characters. So you're transferring something from a static image into a full life form almost. Well, life form is a bit too much of a push, but essentially somewhere on that dimension, right?
Mm. There's still ultimately, though, as in, you know, the skin that effectively goes on them in the form of whatever kind of piece of media you bind with them, whatever image it is, like generally independent of what the actual sort of AI is like. This is where I think what you guys have in terms of, you know, the toggles and the configurability of the kind of almost behavioral patterns or whatever. If you could give some color on that, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. I mean, personality is a unique thing that has been studied by psychologists and anybody who's looked at it. Generally, the framework that most people come up with is the big five personality traits, right? Like openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, neuroticism, assertiveness, yeah. So like you can map out a person on these sort of traits and you can start seeing where they fall on these traits. And to recreate a personality like that is open and extroverted, and at the same time overly conscientious, and then if you imbue that personality with let's go back to the overly attached girlfriend meme, you actually then get an overly attached girlfriend, right? So like that's essentially the major problem, where you can start mapping out personality traits and actually create characters fairly rapidly. You could also create and if there's a what we call a character bible, where for example, if you wanted to recreate Spider-Man and you had the corpus of all of the Marvel comics and all of the dialogues that he has generated, you're then able to put that into a character Bible of sorts, and the AI can learn from that character Bible and create that personality. And then you can add the dials around it in terms of how aggressive or assertive do you want this personality to be? How conscientious do you want it to be? And then you're able to actually get closer to recreating that personality, or even creating a modified personality. So you might have like a Darth Vader character that is a really sincere, earnest helper who wants to guide you to enlightenment, right? Like, or, as opposed to like a Dark Lord of the Sith. So yeah, you can have these unique remixes of personalities that I think is just like we remix music today, we will be able to do the same for virtual characters soon.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think often, you know, we're hesitant to admit how easy it is to actually map a person's character and whatnot. I remember digging in and doing a bunch of reading, you know, around the whole Cambridge Analytica stuff, and they were using exactly that, the ocean stuff, the five things you just listed. And, you know, based off a terrifyingly small amount of questions and answers, the kind of psychographics they can do to model you with like crazy accuracy is really terrifying. So I also wonder, you know, you say you can feed, you gave the Spider-Man example, like I think around the GPT-3 stuff and whatnot, you know, where you can feed people like the entire bibliography of someone or whatever, you know, revive Aristotle and have surprisingly informed discussions with him. Like it's super exciting territory.
Yeah, and I think that's like we have a friend of ours who wants to launch a project called WikiStars on our platform. And essentially the idea is that instead of interacting with like Wikipedia, why don't we just interact with the characters on Wikipedia directly? So if you wanted to ask Aristotle or Plato or Joe Rogan, for example, a question, go ahead and ask him, right? And he'll draw from the corpus of all the publicly available knowledge that is there and come back to you with an answer, right? That is within the realm of the Joe Rogan universe. And so I think like we're moving towards a direction where we, you know, it started off with like MS-DOS and then we moved to sort of graphical user interfaces that we have today. And then we're starting to get into, I mean, conversational user interfaces like Siri and Alexa have been there for a while, but I think like once we move to the next level, which is where we can interact with characters or avatars or embodied beings, like that's sort of the next evolution of where we are going as a species, right?
Absolutely, 100% agree. I mean, I think we're already seeing a massive proliferation, especially in Asia, right? With like virtual streamers and stuff. Like these aren't AI enabled yet. These are mocap, you know, sort of copying facial expressions and body language and all that kind of stuff. But they're insanely popular over there. We're obviously seeing people like Lil Miquela gaining traction in the West. I mean, it's not difficult to imagine billions of these virtual beings within the next 10 years. You know, on the one hand, you've got the virtual streamers, like I say, mocap power by real people, and on the other hand you have you guys imbuing static media with life and character through AI technology like GPT that's also rapidly advancing, right? There'll be a GPT-4 and whatnot. So like, it's kind of crazy when you start thinking like, how the hell are we going to tell what's what? And I guess, you know, you touched upon it early at the start as well, but like, this is where obviously there become problems with virtual beings, you know, moderation, deep fakes, malicious actors, and like ethical considerations. How do you guys approach that? Because it's powerful technology that, you know, obviously can go wrong.
Yeah. I sometimes think a little bit about the what not to do first is a very helpful framework, right? Like one of the major things that we've seen from centralized media platforms is they're somewhat difficult. The enormous challenge that they have in terms of moderating the content that they have in their platform, but also at the same time, their sheer inability to do it effectively despite having so much economic resource and allocations, right? So the main challenge here is, I fundamentally believe, like Twitter, for example, should not have deleted President Trump's tweets, right? That should have been stored as historical record. And it's a very important discussion because if a centralized platform can delete somebody's identity and all of their work and language structure and everything that was created there, we're also deleting a part of human history without consent, right? And where we are right now is where public arena or public communication has been taken over by a larger number of media organizations that sort of control the discourse, right? And what we need to think a little bit about is to what degree should centralized entities govern content moderation and how are they doing it currently? Presently, there aren't really effective guidelines, and we've seen the damage that, for example, YouTube had to deal with hate speech, child porn, all of the different challenges that come up there. And then Twitter, of course, had to deal with all of the issues more recently with late last year, right, with the presidential election. And I think the beginning of that, those mediums are really still limited because it's video for YouTube content, text for Twitter. I mean, they have video and now they're going to audio and all of that. But the major challenge now is if you now create a platform that is oriented around creating synthetic characters and moving towards synthetic reality and actually allowing virtual beings and virtual characters to exist, the challenge actually becomes that the technology is a significantly greater degree more powerful. And how then do you govern and moderate it? So I come from a place of like deep humility on this and that I don't have the full answers, but my framework around this is to try and look at things that have not worked and say that those things have not necessarily worked. So centralization of this decision-making should not occur. It should occur in a decentralized manner. And people should decide what content and what guidelines or what rules should get set around characters and which characters get to spawn and which characters get to be created or not. Some guidelines around that would be extremely helpful because character creation is can be extremely controversial and potent, right? Like it can be a deep match that sort of, it can really cause a lot of problems in society if we create the wrong characters. And for example, we have internally a test, we call it the Hitler test, right? Like, do we allow a character like Hitler to be spawned in our ecosystem? And the earlier, and then have him have that text be trained on GPT-3 and have that guy spew hate speech, have that virtual being spew hate speech 24/7 on a Twitch live stream. Like, that is some level of insanity that certainly can be certainly is within the realms of possibility that some person would abuse a system like that and actually create a character like that. The immediate answer is no, don't allow a character like that to exist. Don't do that at all and stop that from happening. And that's an initial answer that's convenient and very clear. There are some guidelines there. But if you push the analogy further and the example further and you look at the flip side of it, what does that actually do? what it does is that it sometimes favors a counter narrative, which is sort of emerging in Western Europe, where you have Nazis and fascist parties actually coming up and saying that, you know, the Holocaust never existed. It's all a giant lie. All of these things are fake. And this is where the problem occurs. So when you prevent people from understanding what evil is, or understanding what the history, what history was or what happened, and you prevent something like that from being publicly acknowledged, there is a really immense risk that it is going to be forgotten. Because you're not acknowledging that this happened, you're not placing it in the right place. So a wise decentralized organization might come up with a framework, and I don't know whether this is the right answer at all directionally, but something along the lines of what certain libraries do today, where yes, they allow Mein Kampf, the book, to exist only because as historians study it, they understand and recognize that this was evil, that this was harmful, that this was this is how it started, right? So you can have a look at that and you can study it, but maybe it's in a section in the library that's sort of restricted and the access to that is not publicly available. There are not 10,000 versions of Mein Kampf floating around in the library, right? So they're not being printed like the Red Book. So it's really important that we understand the value of ideas and the value of memes and the way that this culture can be shaped rapidly by characters that are 24/7 generated by AI and moving. We're accelerating really quickly to that timeline, and we need. What I know for a fact is no centralized shoulders are heavy can tolerate the heavy burden of a decision like this. I think the people should be able to decide this. And that's the best way to think about a framework that may emerge as we try and tackle some of these more complex topics.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think there's a slight tension, though, between obviously the efficiency and speed of the top-down governance around these things, despite the fact that it's overly burdensome for any single individual or entity to try and execute. And then on the flip side is that, you know, wide-scale distributed governance processes are also still in their infancy, and the technology around that's got a long way to go. Obviously, a lot of it's advancing, a lot of it thanks to crypto and whatnot, but that stuff's still relatively slow moving. So it'll be interesting. In particular, you know, you referenced earlier, you know, we joked about the push notifications or being able to send calendars and stuff. Like this stuff, its potential threat is amplified once they have executive power too. Obviously, it will be defined within narrowly defined executive power, but still, it's super interesting to think about. Definitely got a long way to go on there. I know I think the OpenAI guys are calling for some sort of group discussion around similar stuff. Are they not?
Yeah, absolutely. I think generally OpenAI's approach has been somewhat closed, right? Like they've been very, very protective about the API. They released GPT-2 with a lot of the early models. They released it with a lot of concern and messaging around why this can be abused, the harms, even GPT-3, the paper that they published, language models, a few short learners, just filled with a lot of the harms and trying to inoculate the public against it. But the challenge right now is that, yes, the OpenAI can sort of, you know, sort of close access to its language model. There will be people who are going to create very sophisticated clones of that model and will open source it, right? So there's like, and I know this sounds odd, but there's a open source model out there being built by a group called Eleuther that has essentially forked GPT-3 and is trying to create a very, very similar engine and open source it. And coincidentally, their largest funder on the cloud side is Google, right? And because OpenAI is owned by, is funded by Microsoft rather. So it's interesting to see like competing language models emerge. I think that space is just starting. So I believe like in 1 to 3 years, we may have a language model from Huawei that is being used by people in Asia, a language model from Google and Microsoft that is being used in everyday AI. You can have language models from IBM that, you know, it's not Watson, but probably a significantly more enhanced version of Watson that are being used by enterprises and businesses, right? So like, we're going to see a tremendous competition in this space where you're going to see a lot of impact and innovation get created when text content and generative output sounds very human and can reason. And right now we're only at sort of, you know, the third model, but you can imagine GPT-10 or GPT-7 or 8, like moving leaps and bounds above what it can do today. So that's where we are. And I think where we are going is just greater reality and fidelity, right? Like a higher fidelity that represents reality. And we're going to see the same progress across human voice, face swapping, face generation, like what, for example, I think MetaHuman, the character creator, as well, right? And just hyper real and getting closer and closer there. And the main thing is that the intelligence behind these characters should match that, and the voice should match that. So you'll note that perhaps in MetaHuman's video, I think that when they launched it, I don't think the characters are speaking, right? Because the moment the characters start to speak, if memory serves me correctly, the brain does something unique as well, where it needs to feel as if the character is truly human, and the voice perception and the audibility of the voice also contributes to the uncanny valley. So anybody who's trying to cross the uncanny valley, they have a huge valley to sort of cross, right? So I think that we are getting there in terms of this, but I also see a huge design space to play within the uncanny valley itself, and also to allow characters, whether they are cartoons, animated NFTs, or any sort of new IP that's emerging, to actually start becoming interactive and engaging.
Absolutely. It's super interesting. So we dwelled for a moment on, you know, some of the risks, some of the threats, some of the potential downside. But I'm curious what you see as some of the really interesting, really exciting kind of longer term ideas for how these things might evolve and some of the use cases around them.
Yeah, I think one thing, you know, I shared a little bit about this, which was I think human memory and the ability for people to remember their cultural heritage and understand it is going to play a very powerful role here. So let's say if your parents or even us, right, like we write a lot of content today, and one day we may or may not have progeny, but we may have we may want to preserve our language structure and our voice and our face, so that we can then share a story with our great-grandkids who are not even yet born, right? And I think like the ability to transfer language like this, just like we would write a book, but then have that interface be an avatar, have that ability to interact with it, it's like a really powerful time capsule that actually allows people to go back and actually have full interactions. And just as a start, like, I mean, Deep Nostalgia recently, I think about 2 months ago, perhaps they launched the ability to just move a person's eyes, right? Like animate a photo. That was all they were doing. And people were having such emotional reactions when they would upload a photo of their parents or grandparents and see them move in a realistic way. And they found it creepy, but then they also found it very, very emotional. But now take that to the next level. What if you could actually interact with them and engage with them and understand their worlds, understand their suffering, understand their point of view, understand why they got married, understand what their fears were? I think like the opportunities here are just to enrich cultural memory and history, to tap into who we are as a species. Like it creates an opportunity for us to become better preservers of our stories, but also better storytellers, because we can then articulate who we were, and we can also then try and figure out where we want to go with our lives as we try and provide context. So I see like this, there's a quote from Patek Philippe that I like to quote, because they stole it from the Native Americans, right? And it's that you don't own the land, you merely safeguard it for the next generation. That was the original quote from the Native American tribes. And then Patek Philippe, of course, took it and said, you don't own a Patek Philippe, you merely safeguard it for the next generation. Right? So sort of comical, a capitalistic twist on this, right? But I'd say, if we go a little bit further, I don't think, what I think is likely to occur is like people may own INFTs, they may own intelligent NFTs that have embedded language structures in them, and they may pass them down to their kids, and their kids may pass them down to their kids, because everything's stored there is the NFT as a property rights layer, so that's a unique asset, and the language structure is embedded in that prompt. And so that's all of that gets passed down or within a family structure. So I see this opportunity to preserve our cultural heritage, and also the opportunity to unlock even like secrets, right? Like if you think about it, you can embed secrets in the prompt. You can embed like if somebody talks to a character and says a specific keyword or a phrase, that character is then able to unlock that specific experience and maybe gift a new NFT to the characters. Also, there's so much gamification and programmability here. And we're just like at the first sort of design stage of what actually we can program into this beautiful medium.
I think that's a really beautiful idea that I hadn't really considered, that it will enhance our cultural heritage. And funnily enough, if you extrapolate, that's actually a similar headspace to where Nick Bostrom was when he wrote the original simulation theory paper, right? That at some point in the far future, those that come after us are going to want to run these ancestor simulations. That's where they end up. And I love, the idea of passing them on, you know, from one generation to another. I think some of the really cool stuff around this becomes around like the concept of almost the group avatar. Like you have the little Michaela that is like some performer or entertainer in some capacity that actually earns revenues, and like maybe multiple people like govern this character that's, you know, digitally native to the internet, and like performs and goes on streams and does all this cool stuff and is intelligent, and you know, this group of people that sort of co-own it and co-govern it, you know, obviously participate in the economics and also mold and help shape how they want it to be. I think that's a really interesting, cool angle where this could go.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think this, you know, I call it in my course, we are, you know, it sounds really odd, man, but like when I looked at the pet rock phenomenon, I was doing my research, it's like, why are people attached to a pet rock? And fundamentally, we are at a very deep core level, a storytelling species. We need a level of, we need a deep ability. We have a deep desire and an endless need to make meaning and make stories out of things. And it seems like a very simple thing to say that we are storytelling creatures or we like to tell stories, but it is actually a very deep, profound point, because without stories, we completely lack the ability to set context, and metaphor has always played a very significant role in our language structure. And so how we inherit, how we learn, how we memorize, all of these things are part of our innate nature as a storytelling species, right? So anything that enhances that ability, we are innately and intrinsically drawn to it. And the ability now to do that with artificial intelligence, right? Like, and to have that be a multiplier effect, and then to have that be generative and then also provoke and even inspire new forms of art and meaning, like that is hybrid. It's going to be something very, very fascinating and interesting. So I think there is a deep opportunity here to lean on AI to help support us, but also there are some considerations around what sort of content should we try and articulate or create from a standpoint, and what that means for like you know, like when an AI generates a piece of music or an AI generates a patent, right? Like what happens then, you know, when AI agents can do that effectively, and that's really the sort of shared design space we will need to inhabit and ask questions on once we get to that level. The problem though is that you know, like GPT-3, where we are right now at with it, it can simulate meaning, it can pretend as if it's understanding, but really deep understanding is something that is uniquely human right now. Although people will we as a species ourselves may not fully understand human intelligence. So I think like as we go down further the rabbit hole of creating more intelligent AI, inadvertently we will learn so much more about ourselves as a species. And that, for example, is like, you know, terra incognita, where we really need to explore.
Man, I mean, I really liked you when we first met last year, but this instills me with so much confidence knowing how, you know, philosophically grounded you are in sort of your approach to all this. I think it's super important, obviously, when sort of engaging an undertaking like this. So super, super interesting to hear all your thoughts there. I couldn't agree more. I think it's super interesting. I wanted to ask, obviously, this is very much interwoven with where we're going when we refer to this idea of the metaverse. So I'm curious to what extent you subscribe to this idea. And for the sake of clarity, I will define it as a persistent live digital universe that affords individuals a sense of agency, social presence, and shared spatial awareness, along with the ability to participate in an extensive virtual economy with profound societal impact.
Yeah. No, that is a very comprehensive definition. I have a question for you. Have you ever experienced lucid dreaming?
I have. Interestingly, I actually kept a dream journal for about 18 months and was like ridiculously disciplined doing binaural beats and like waking up at regular intervals in the night. I managed to do it a few times. So, yeah.
Yeah. No. And do you think like a lucid dream is a metaverse?
It's an interesting question. I never thought about it. I mean, no, in that it's confined to your own, you know, internal noetic realm or whatever it's called, right? There's no interconnectivity. I think the social presence and shared spatial awareness aspect of that definition, like, well, the spatial awareness, fine, but I think being able to share some experience, which maybe isn't grounded in the natural world, but, you know, in these virtual worlds, like that's a really interesting dimension of the metaverse, which I think, you know, you're lacking in a lucid dream, because as much as I would love to share my lucid dreams with other people, I don't think we can just yet.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I'm just going to take that analogy a little bit further, because the metaverse is this beautiful simulation that we want to create that has virtual economies, interactions, engagements. And, you know, there is a really interesting sort of Tibetan Buddhist practice around lucid dreaming that the theory, as I understood it from a scholar of the mind, was just broadly that in lucid dreams, if you are not careful and you actually create a lucid dream and you go in and you are an agent, you are then existing at a level of reality or simulation with other souls and beings. And if you're not careful, the currency in a lucid dream, the virtual economy in a lucid dream, is your karma. And if you do things in the lucid dream that is out of practice or out of alignment or out of integrity, you accrue karma that then gets acted upon in a different dimension, which is your physical being that you exist on, right? So like in that sort of lucid dream, I would say that the currency that we're talking about, or the virtual economy, it's the economy of the soul, where the soul's evolution, where you're trying to think a little bit about how do we progress the human soul. And this is a slightly spiritual metaphysical lens to look at things, but the way that they've thought about it is that your dreams are a space for your unconscious to sort of find its purpose and meaning and rejig itself and have an opportunity to rest, and also at the same time be able to integrate what is happening on a day-to-day basis. The opportunity to learn a meditative technique like lucid dreaming, where you can then go sort of into an altered reality or an altered state of consciousness. Really, it is an altered state of consciousness. It is actually, in my opinion, a sort of metaverse. A metaverse that is created by the mind with interconnected with other minds. Now, I don't have like a scientific theory around this, but the closest person I think who has looked at this a little bit, maybe Rupert Sheldrake, where he was, I believe, studying the underlying patterns of like animal movements and how that sort of corresponds to a collective consciousness. So my sense is that we are already creating metaverses with our mind. We are already creating metaverses in our dream state. Where we are really wanting to go in this new metaverse reality is sort of a three-dimensional program or simulation that is hyper-realistic, high fidelity, and completely immersive and interactive, where we can fulfill our full, complete beings and desires. And I really like that, because I think the sort of Ready Player One dystopian dynamic is definitely possible in the way that the world is aligned today to like capitalism as the god that we all worship, right? But if we start to look at open approaches that are starting to come to fray, I'm really excited about the possibilities of metaverses like Decentraland, Crypto Voxel, Somnium Space coming to life and having people populate and inhabit this. Of course, they're really, really early, but I think sort of an open multiverse, metaverse world will exist, where you may have just like interoperable blockchains, you'll have interoperable metaverses that allow people to enter a different dimension and exit as a different character or person as well. Right? So I think the vastness of the human mind is going to be represented in this new simulation we create. And there will be so many different micro simulations and so many different universes, metaverses that we will be spoiled for choice, right? I think the main thing that needs to be considered is sort of the economic design of these metaverses, because like that movie, there is that movie Inception where, and there's a scene where Leonardo DiCaprio, or they go into a basement and they see all of these people sleeping in the dream state, and all of them are connected and they're trying to I believe they were all intentionally in the dream state so that they could participate in that reality. So I think there is a deep level of importance in that we physically ourselves are anchored in the world, and that we're not locked in or plugged into the matrix without our free will or consciousness. And for me, like, that free will or consciousness is very important, because if you look at the scope creep of traditional tech companies, how they've creeped into our day-to-day attention spans. And it's very, very subtle. It's that red notification. It's the endless newsfeed. It's the slight ding on your iPhone. All of these things are scope creep into our consciousness, because they shape our brain, and our brains are neuroplastic, right? And for a large part of it, if we have a metaverse that is even more higher fidelity and designed not just around scope creep, but just complete control of the individual will, that can be somewhat dangerous, because then you can really create a type of metaverse level slavery that may be deeply, deeply harmful, right? So I think those are some of the thoughts I have, and I try to inform it from a metaphysical standpoint first, and then try to think through it. But I just cannot, right now in its current iteration, we are sort of headed definitely towards like a capitalist metaverse, if not for the more recent decentralized technologies that are coming out. So sorry for the rant there, but it's just
not at all. It's very useful color. And I think, yeah, that's the aspect of all of these technologies at the moment that are most exciting to me, at least, this concept of the open metaverse, where, you know, user sovereignty is like the number one design goal or whatever. I think it's super interesting. To be honest, I'd never really considered the lucid dream to metaverse analogy, but like, you can kind of see how we could explore the metaverse, the digital route, and keep evolving the brain computer interface until we do reach inception level. You know, everyone goes into their dream state and is directly connected through some crazy godlike technology that we'll unlock. And then I don't know, it gets pretty interesting. I'll have to dwell on that for sure. But heading into the closing questions, I'm very curious, what is your favorite video game ever?
My favorite video game ever?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, so this brings me probably back to my childhood. I think it was the first one I played that my dad bought me. I remember because, my dad, he's a scientist, and he studied quite a bit, but you know, he had a difficult life, and he was a cab driver. But he got me this video game console, the Super Nintendo. He got the cartridges, and then I was playing this game, which was, it sounds odd, but it's just Mortal Kombat, right? I just learned from a friend. We had a friend over, and they had taught me the first time how to do a fatality or a brutality. And I know it sounds like really lame, but it was just the first joyful, I mean, it was a really joyful experience for me to have the ability to like see characters move and interact. And I was able to actually do all of that. Right. So that was like, I don't know, in the mid 90s, right. Like early 90s. So that was the first version. And then later on, I mean, it was just like LAN shops were sprouting around Singapore, and you could then enter and play Counter-Strike with your friends, and like all of the iterations, World of Warcraft, all of that started coming naturally.
Super cool. Yeah. I think we're on Mortal Kombat 11 now. It's gotten so out of hand. It's so brutal to play now. But it's pretty fun still. Yeah. And then I'm really curious as well. You know, you've obviously spent a lot of time thinking pretty philosophically about a lot of these technologies, the ones you're contributing to and whatnot. But I guess beyond video games, what is the most impactful digital experience you've ever had?
Yeah, I think one time I was really deep into meditative practices for the period, because I had just burnt out in, you know, after working for tech companies, and I was just exhausted with like the endless notifications, all of that. I spent some time in San Francisco, I was meditating, and there were some headbands that were coming to market still in the earlier days. I had a very profound experience when I put on a headband. I think it's called the Muse. I think they're still around right now. And essentially, they had an app that starts to chirp as your brain achieves a coherent state of consciousness. It has ECG nodes on it. and it starts to pick up your brainwaves. And I was able to get to a state of like blissful chirping for about 10 to 15 minutes, I think. And it was a very profound experience with this piece of technology because it allowed me to attain a level of clarity and calmness in my mind that oftentimes I find impossible to attain. So it's a digital experience, but at the end of the day, it was also a conscious one. Like it was something that made me better as a person. So I thought that was kind of neat and cool. And I don't know, maybe one day we'll all be able to even tokenize brainwaves. like when you attain a certain brainwave state, suddenly you get an NFT that you have now attained enlightenment. This is your badge, right? Mm. Enter the dojo, right? So yeah. We don't know where this stops, right?
That's a super interesting answer though. That's the first I've had to that question, which was like, a digital experience that had like a directly physiological impact. Obviously, you could argue that any experience is a physiological impact, but you get my point. It's super interesting. I think some of the work being done around that, like the very rudimentary, you still call it a BCI to some degree, right? The stuff that's been, there's a company called OpenBCI that's been working, I think, with the Vive headsets, or maybe it's Valve working with them as well. I know that like Facebook was also looking at a company in the space. Some of that electroencephalograph stuff where they do measure the brain waves is really crazy. I was at a conference in like 2016 and some Swedish guy was building this cool VR app, and you put the thing on and it like you're seeing all of these weird amorphous 3D shapes blobbing around you, and they change in like rhythm and color temperature based upon what brain state you're in. And obviously it's a very early unevolved example of it, but it's crazy to experience. It's super, super interesting how well that stuff might one day work. Then out of all the books you've ever read, which one has resonated with you the most?
The one that has made a big difference early on and later on as a rereading was Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. The first time I read it, I became like this selfish version of myself. And then the next time I read it, I discovered how broken that philosophy was. Just one of complete self-interest, where that leads us down. So I remember reading the first version of it like when I was 15 or 16 and finding it to be deeply resonant in the form of like, this ideal objective individual that just speaks facts and the truth, and later on and has the ability to earn an infinite amount of money and accrue an infinite amount of capital, and then the most competent people rise up in the most fair meritocratic system in the most fair meritocratic capitalist system. To a large degree, we do live in a very fortunate meritocratic society in the West, right? But later on, as I began seeing the deep harms of new forms of colonialism, like one would think that we are way past colonialism, but we're not at all. If you look at the enormous amount of parasitic vampire loans that have been given to emerging countries, right? Like let's take Pakistan as an example. Impossible to pay off and impossible to even get out of. On top of that, you have the elements of radicalization, you have the elements of war in neighboring countries, you have the elements of a military takeover or dictatorship for a certain period of time. You combine all these things together, and then you tell me how does Atlas Shrugged fit into that model, where a world that is so broken, how does a competent individual rise up? So it just seems to me that the first time I read it, it made such a deep and profound impact on me because it allowed me to visualize and imagine myself as a different person. But the second reading and a deeper reading, I realized how broken the ideas were because, and it's funny, there are like top level policymakers in the US that just look at Atlas Shrugged as a Bible. It's quoted as the second greatest book after the Bible in the US. And I'm like, I don't think people really deeply understand the power of the meme. And Ayn Rand was a great meme master or meme lord herself, right? Or meme queen, whatever you want to call her. But at the end of it, it was just a shallow philosophy. So sorry for the long answer, but that book, I had to read it twice. And that's why it made a deep impact on me.
No, appreciate the long answer there. It's super interesting. That's most of the questions I wanted to get through, really. What would you say is some of the key trends to watch this year for, you guys and, the technology you're working on?
Yeah, I think we're going to be doing some really cool stuff with INFTs. Don't worry, we won't be bringing the overly attached girlfriend to you anytime soon. right. So, but I just think like this is the year for it to really take off. And there is a lot of design space and opportunity. We're partnering with some really cool artist communities, but also some really cool protocol projects that want to build their character personas. There's a lot of pseudonymous characters that want to have the avatar. So we're speaking with the wonderful folks at the Metaverse team, the folks about the Beeple's art piece, and they want to do something really cool with their avatars and their decentralized parcels. So there's something there that's cooking that I can't talk too much about publicly, but I think that there's some really, really interesting things coming up. And I think this year, once we can start to get people to plug in the NFTs and give the NFT superpowers and see how the medium evolves, I'm really looking forward to a CryptoPunk battling with a hash mask, talking to a waifu, and then all of them deciding that they should have NFT children together. I don't know. You know, that's how it can evolve, right? Like that's how generative it can be. So I'm excited about the possibilities this year, and we'll be rolling and launching out our pods in the coming weeks, which will allow people to essentially create these NFTs.
Awesome. Love to hear it. All sounds very exciting. For those listening, which is the best place to, follow along with all of this stuff? Where should they find you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can find me on Twitter at ARKHAN. I don't often tweet that much, but my DMs are open. I prefer to read and listen on Twitter just because there's so much wisdom there. But on aletheia.ai, aletheia.ai, you'll have a chance to use our characters, existing characters, and actually make them talk and speak. And we have a Telegram community that's getting pretty active, and we'll be rolling out more platforms soon to communicate. So definitely follow us on Twitter at real_aletheia, and we'll be posting a lot of updates there.
Brilliant. Well, Arif, I really appreciate you taking the time. Fascinating discussion. And yeah, really, really excited to see all that comes this year for you guys. And look forward to having you back on the podcast at some point in the future. Maybe by then you will have just morphed into a piece of synthetic media yourself. We'll see.
And that might be a more interesting version of me. You never know, right?
So, somehow I doubt that, but we'll see. Thanks a lot, Arif. Have a good one.
Take care. Thank you.